that's what you want and you can sit in a room and not interact with people from a business environment, then knock yourselves out. I do not believe that that is the case for most people. And I believe so much is human and it's context. It's feeling. I mean, as somebody who's a huge digital advocate, I think people are sometimes surprised by how much real life stuff I want to do. I do, I care to do and don't use video conferencing and things of that nature. So, you know, that's me. I'm good at people stuff. I feel like being in the room helps me. Not being on the phone or being on Skype, is a lot of times the reason I won something. And so, that's on you, and you do you. If you're not good in a room, and, you know, then maybe you should sit in your house and try to do everything video conferencing and email style. So I think this is reverse engineering how you roll. Most importantly, it's also understanding that technology will never take the human element out of things. Humans are humans for a reason. It's always going to happen. As much as I think we're going to become robots, I don't think it's going to happen in the next 10 to 15 to 30 years. So I highly recommend the practicality of what the human upside brings to the table.
How do I keep my old employees from hazing my new employees?
This was a huge problem for me at Wine Library. I mean, literally in our prime, 5 years into my organization, I had a real core team. 2003 to 2007, that 4 year window. I apologize for anybody who's listening to this that came into Wine Library. Literally on your first day with no training, no onboarding. We didn't have any of that. We'd throw you out into the store to do whatever the hell you were supposed to do. And literally you were judged within the first 2 hours of your day. It used to drive me crazy because they were judged by the same people that sucked for the first 6 months when they were there too, because there's no training and no blue book and no strategy and no onboarding. And so, I think you do it by A, being patient, two, instilling humility into the people that are doing the hazing. I mean, that's how I got away with it. I kind of razzed those people. I kind of reminded them that they were just like them a couple of years earlier and started really cutting people that weren't able to deploy that empathy. And so it's not really hard if you care to do it. I think none of these questions are hard. It comes down to the actions. But I think it comes down to leadership. If you let it happen, it's going to happen. You know, I would run down there those 4 years and it took a long time for me to I had to fire one major person, which sucked because I really gave them 7 chances. Back to an earlier recall question. But he just couldn't get there. And so eventually, and it opened the floodgates. Once that happened, it got better. And that's that.
How much of your staff's time is spent on you as opposed to other projects?
Well, if you're talking about Team Gary, right? You know, D-Rock, India, Brittany, Andy Kay, Alex C. Simone, Zach, Stefan, Andrew, don't want to leave anybody else, Sid, the intern. They're using all their time. They're on my brand. Everybody else is not at all. I think there's, you know, VaynerMedia is not built to build the Gary V brand. They're there for client work. So I have it siloed out on my team. I think my comms team, my PR team bleeds a little bit. But other than that, I mean, the occasional, I'll ask somebody for a favor or jump into this, but there's, please don't let it be confused. And I think this is important when you've got multiple things going on in an organization. You silo them out. Back to that Navy SEALs and kind of the Army, my little ninja team that works on my brand works on my team as if I was, you know, Pepsi or Toyota. And so that's that.
How do you handle it when people miss their deadlines?
I hate missing a deadline because it's a black and white KPI. I always tell my employees, look, the creative is subjective. They may or may not like it, but getting it done on Tuesday is not subjective. Like if it's there Thursday, they're like, you did wrong. So I don't love it. At the same token, I always want to know why. I mean, look, if I find out that a client was waiting for something a long time and they're upset, but I find out it was because 3 people were sick and then we went to get a freelancer, that didn't work out. Like, I'm always prepared for a proper excuse. I hate when people are like, there's no excuses. Of course there are. There's circumstances. There's things that happen. And so the way I react is I become Sherlock Holmes. If I care to know, which is rare because 99% of things don't matter, but if I care to know, I will jump into Sherlock Holmes mode. I will listen and I'm lenient. So that's that. But like 50% of the time, I'm like, oh, okay, makes sense. Let's not do it again. 50% of the time, I'm like, hey man, hey gal, this is something we need to fix permanently. So don't let it happen again. And that's it. That's how I handle it.
How do you diplomatically tell the boss he's screwing it up?
All depends on the company. All depends on your situation. If you're a 24-year-old and mom and dad got your back and are willing to pay your rent, You've got a little more audacity to lose your job than if you've got, you know, a $100,000 student loan and a kid in a studio apartment and, you know, bills that are racked up. You're probably going to be a little bit more political. So first and foremost, I want to deploy empathy to all and every situation. But if you've decided to go there, I'm a big fan of honey over vinegar. Hedge. Here's my question. Do you want to basically tell somebody screw off, or do you want it to actually be fixed? If you want somebody to just get punched in the mouth and tell them to fuck off, right? Well, then come guns a-blazing, be like, you suck. But if you actually want it fixed, start with honey. Hey, John, I know that you're managing all of us, and that must be tough. I couldn't even imagine. But, you know, hey, we need to fix this, that, and the other thing. So I think diplomacy and being a real politician and starting with honey and then delivering your vinegar is a very good way to get a boss to change something. But are you interested in it changing, or are you just at wit's end and just want to let off some steam and let the chips fall? And so I think this is more on you than them.
When trying to get your point across to meet a goal, do you prefer to be abrasive or compassionate, and why?
I like everything. I think all emotions can be successful. I like having a tool belt of all emotions to deploy when I'm trying to get something achieved. I think what I really hope is that I have context and I know the person and I can really reverse what motivates them. So the more I know about the person, whether it's the client or whether it's an employee, the more likely I'll know which tool to bring out that time. Is it, you know, the nunchucks or the gun or the spear? You know, like what am I need to bring out this time to get the job done? And so I tend to lead with honey as often as possible. I really think compassion works. But sometimes, you know, you just gotta use the alternatives, and I'm willing to do that as well.
What are your suggestions when you have to work with external partners to get the job done, but they don't share your hustle?
First, I want to come through for whoever you're coming through for. So if you're building a park for the town, first and foremost, you gotta build the park. And so along the way, you may be frustrated as hell because Rick is sitting and drinking a beer under the tree and you're digging holes for the playground. Obviously, this is the analogy I'm using for a deck, for a project, for a pop-up shop, for an activation, for an event, for, you know, selling stuff. It applies to everything. As long as the judge and jury of the project knows what the score is, nothing bothers me. When we work with other agencies that are just using us up to be profitable on the project in their hourly wages, as long as the client then gives us more business in the future, I don't have a problem. It's when that balance doesn't work out. It's when meritocracy doesn't come through that you only have one option. I tend to leave. I'm always an A player. My organizations are always an A player. We're always going to play nice in the sandbox. We're not going to undermine people along the way. We're going to watch if the judge and jury, aka the client, recognizes this. If they don't, I will have a conversation. If they don't react to that conversation, I'll fire them. I don't have to stay in a bad relationship, but I don't have to complain about it along the way.
If you have a business that's growing fast, is it more important to perfect the system or to focus on adding more people to the team?
Both. The answer to this question is 100% both. I do believe that this is an insight to one of my best talents. I'm able to, I'm sorry, I'll just use it because I heard it recently. Flying the plane while you're fixing it if it's broken. There's no other way to win because if you stop, you're not moving. And if you're moving without fixing, you're crashing. It's both, it's both, it's both. And I have big news for all of you. It's repairing and flying forever, always, till the end of time. This is nothing that ever stops. You're always parenting. I met a 90-year-old the other day, and we got to talking. I talk to old people on trips because they've lived life, and so I like the context. Asked me if I had kids, said 6 and 3. He goes, I have a 71-year-old. You're always parenting. And I just laughed, and I'm like, makes sense. It's like a business. It's just always the game. And so the answer is both. The only time you stop is when you sell your business. Otherwise, if you're stopping, you're creating a vulnerability in one or the other, in your growth or your continuity or your upside or your profitability or many other things. So be prepared for the challenge of moving and fixing along the way. Chapter 16, investing. In this chapter, I'll talk about what to look for in a horse, what to look for in a jockey, and my best hack for finding the new hot investment possibility. Aside from queries looking for beginner entrepreneurial advice, I probably get more emails asking me to consider investing in startups than any other. I have a lot of evolving feelings about being an investor. By now, I've probably looked at tens of thousands of deals, and yet it's still a pretty new role for me. My investing career didn't follow the most traditional path. Most successful investors probably start small, take a few missteps, and have some success here and there before they finally get into a position to hit the motherlode. I kind of did that backwards. What happened was I started recognizing that I had been right about a lot of things like email marketing, e-commerce in general, banner advertising, and Google AdWords. And then one day, I read that YouTube, the video sharing platform that I had begun saying was going to be huge, had sold to Google for $2 billion. It occurred to me that maybe all this right stuff could probably make me a lot more money than just selling a few extra bottles of Cabernet. So I promised myself that whatever I spotted as the next big thing, it could have been a chewing gum as easily as a new digital platform, I would try to get involved. That thing was called Twitter. Twitter caught my attention in 2006 and 7. While everyone else debated the value of a platform that lets you tell the world you were eating pizza, I recognized it as a communication platform that would change the world. I became bullish on Twitter and consequently became friends with early employees. Eventually, an opportunity came in the form of one employee deciding to sell off all of his stock. By the way, as a side note, I spent most of my time trying to talk him out of that emotional decision, which I ended up unfortunately being right, but he's a great guy, but it is what it is. He sold it all. And I was able at that moment to pick up a ton of Twitter stock at an incredibly low valuation. Once that happened, I stepped back and took note that there was another platform that was interesting to me called Tumblr. I'd noticed that a lot of high school students, one in specific, Louis Janot, who now works at VaynerMedia, were using Tumblr, and he told me that everyone he knew was on Tumblr. I knew at that point it was going mainstream. From that point, I became friends with founder David Karp and president John Maloney. They were looking for marketing ideas, and by 2008, I had established myself as a personality in the space. That gave me the opportunity to invest in its B round at a ridiculously low-level valuation. Subsequently, it sold to Yahoo for $1 billion. During that same period, maybe within a month, my 2-year relationship with several Facebook employees put me in a position to invest also in a very low valuation when some Facebook family members decided to sell stock. So within an incredibly short period of time, I made 3 investments in what turned out to be 3 massively profitable events for me. I started off hot. Maybe it was inevitable that when I finally stumbled, it would be a faceplant of epic proportions. Get this. I was actually in the room in Paris when Garrett Camp was first pitching the idea of Uber to Travis Kalanick, and I and a couple of others. We didn't spend that much time on it, by the way, which is a little fun note, but clearly they spent more time on it later. As a matter of fact, in my first book that many of you read called Crush It, if you're in your home right now or your office, go and grab it and go to the acknowledgement page. I have it here in front of me. I'm going to read you a little part of my acknowledgments page in 2009, long before Uber was invented. And finally, this would not be the book it is without the thoughtful comments of Travis Kalanick, who gave me the perfect feedback in late innings. That's right, many years before he became the famous CEO of Uber and one of the most iconic businessmen of this generation, Travis was just a great, great friend of mine who's angel investing alongside. And yet, after all that, I passed on investing in the Uber angel round twice. When you put that into context, just lightweight, that $25,000 or $50,000 check that I was writing for many other companies around that time would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars today. Pretty tough. If I had gone in, it would probably be changing my life immensely. It sure would have gotten me a lot closer to buying the New York Jets. I like to refer to this event as my almond moment. After the Ask Gary Vee episode where I promised the Vayner Nation that anyone that could guess the number of almonds that were filling the big glass jar on my table, I'd pay their way to New York and they could sit with me during the next episode. There were 1,424 almonds in the jar. At Boost Lacrosse, with two O's, I want to give them a shout out now because you're not going to believe this, guessed that there was 1,423 almonds. One almond off. Close, but no cigar. And that's right, as a side note, I did not fly him in. I stuck to my word. Everybody thought I should do something. Nope. I'm not into eighth place trophies. I'm not into second place trophies. Luckily, Travis gave me another shot later, and I invested and I grabbed a little bit later at a much higher, much, much higher valuation. And I'm sure Boost Lacrosse won't let the next big opportunity slip away either. The almond jar always gets refilled. And when it does, you try again. I learned from my mistake and was lucky enough to go on to become part of a small group of super angels, men and women with personal brand awareness like Kevin Rose, Chris Sacca, and Jason Calcanis, looking for opportunities to invest. I later made some nice investments in companies like Wildfire and Birchbox, and eventually, in late 2013, I started a venture fund with Stephen Ross and Matt Higgins and my brother AJ called Vayner RSC, a $25 million seed fund that invests in early-stage internet media companies. By the time you're listening to this, I'll have another fund called Vayner Capital, which is now a late-stage venture fund writing bigger checks in companies that are a little bit more mature. I've been watching and learning, and I think we're living in interesting times. I see a lot of young companies going for the investments, and then instead of building up their businesses, they spend all their time working towards the next round of funding. There seems to be a disturbing lack of patience and scrappiness out there in investment land, to the point that I've changed the way I consider businesses. In fact, I go so far to advise a lot of businesses to reconsider going for VC money at all. It's useful, to be sure, but I think it can make people lazy. The company whose founders have made great things happen on a shoestring and spent every dime and drop of sweat on building the best product they can before reaching out to VC dollars, that's the company I've got my eye on.
Hey, everyone. This is Christy Kerr, 18-time tour winner on the LPGA Tour. I am so excited to be reading the next questions in the Ask Gary Vee book. Thanks for having me. Question number one, what should I focus on with the companies that I invest in?
Look, I mean, I think you should be focusing on the entrepreneur, right? I think the jockey matters more than the horse. Actually, Christy, let's use you as an example. I'd much more focus on you than the clubs that you use, right? You're going to make any club work because you're great at golf. And I think way too many people focus on the clubs and the cleats. And again, in this world, it's the business. Oh, that's a great idea. Cupcakes that get delivered on demand in 1 second when you hit a button. But if the operator doesn't know how to build a marketplace, how to build the app that delivers that, how to employ people that can actually make that happen, you lose. The number one thing that I've learned in investing is bet on the jockey over the horse. A lot of times the jockey changes the horse and still makes you money.
Question number two. You've said that sometimes you invest in horses or companies and sometimes in the jockeys, founders. What do you look for in each?
Off of the rant that I just drilled on you, let me talk a little bit about the companies. They're the compelling ideas that I secretly am so blown away by, and I'm like, oh my God, I just saw the future, that I'm willing to hold my breath if I don't believe in the founder. Now, by the way, the Holy Grail is like, look at that horse and look at that jockey. And that was what Facebook was. Oh my God, look at Zucks, look at Facebook. But there's been times where I bet on businesses because they're so compelling. They're so right. They are in my thesis. The way I would look at virtual reality and esports companies right now, I believe in those spaces so much that if I see a jockey, a CEO that I don't fully believe in, there's a part of my brain that says, well, she or he will get it to a certain level, then we'll replace the CEO and I'll still make money. I've got companies in my portfolio that are right there right now. And so that's why I would bet on a horse, aka a company. Jockeys, I just explained to you, I always believe in the best jockeys are willing to pivot, willing to adjust, willing to change their business model. It's unbelievable how that actually works, and so that's self-explanatory.
Question number three. What's your stance on investing in competitive companies?
This came across my desk very early on in my investing career. Probably the fifth or sixth investment I ever made was a company called Gowalla, which was competing with a company called Foursquare. Now, most of you know Foursquare, or maybe you've heard about it in the 2011-12, that range. I'd invested in Gowalla, and I had a chance to invest in Foursquare, which is at that point the leader, at a little bit of a later round, but still very underpriced in my opinion. And at that point, some people were doing those kind of things. I just couldn't wrap my head around. Remember what my dad said? I didn't understand how to be involved on both sides of the equations. Like, how do you root for the Carolina Panthers and the Denver Broncos in a Super Bowl? You can't. You got to pick one. And I felt that I gave my word to Gowalla by my investment and my time and my brains. And so I don't do it. I know that some people do as hedging their bet. I know that some companies are okay with investors doing that because they just want the money. It's just not for me.
Question number four. You talk a lot about upcoming companies and predicting their success. Where and how do you find these companies?
You know, first I follow tastemakers that are covering things like that. I'm a big fan of Jason Hirschhorn's Redef newsletter. He talks about stuff like that. Tech Meme is an aggregator of tech blogs, which they're just writing a story of like, blah, 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 gets funded. And I'm like, oh, what's that? Recode, a great blog. I love Nuzzle. Nuzzle is an app that I passed on that might be another regret, that aggregates my Twitter feed of my friends and allows me to see things. But my number one favorite hack is to go to the iTunes store and see what the top 150 apps are in the iOS platform. And then that's how I found Yik Yak and Snapchat and Musical.ly and Dubsmash. Like, I watch trends based on raw data. It's not opinions. It's just raw data. This is what's doing well. And so I keep my eye very close to that. And don't forget, I'm now established as a venture capitalist, one that's popular and has done well. And so a lot of stuff's coming to me, like literally emails that are like, we have this idea. We'd love to meet with you. I mean, that's exciting to me. I'm getting to see stuff very, very early. I try to give you three examples of things that you can do. That was uniquely, that last one's uniquely for me. Get the results and let the bees come to you.
Question number five. What usually prompts you to walk away from great opportunities?
You know, usually it's my intuition. In hindsight, a lot of times it's been my lack of education. This is not something I touched on the show. This is an added value kind of question. I often say my intuition because it's been wrong at times, but it's been right more than wrong, and that's why I use it. I think the other thing, and the maturity of my venture capital experience I think is about to happen, is the data. Like, I think that, meaning I didn't have a full view of the competitive landscape, and now that I have analysts and a more mature fund, I've got the math along with my intuition that allows me to make much better decisions. So the lack of knowledge around everything has definitely been the way I've passed on things. Lack of foresight. I didn't see Uber. That's, there's nothing else to say. I didn't see Airbnb. I didn't see it early enough. I saw it way earlier than other people, not early enough to really win. And so that's happened. And that's that. But listen, I've got to trust my intuition. It's been so good to me. And so if you're somebody who's not done as well on your intuition, you need to take that as a real thing and bring in somebody intuitive. Too many of you are trying to make your intuition work. It's either going to work or not. Your skill might be running the data and analyzing. And there's been plenty of people that have beaten me on the math versus my skill, my natural intuition skill. I've lost that game plenty of times. I've won that game plenty of times. So you got to bet on your strengths. Another good example to push that.
Question number six. How do you balance risk and reward?
I personally do it with optimism, which means I'm looking at the reward more than the risk. I'm not scared. I take risks every day. I'm a true bred 100% entrepreneur. I don't know anything else. First of all, I accept risk in everything, yet I don't respect risk. I don't. It's an interesting thing. I'm aware of it, but I'm not scared of you, risk. I'm looking over to the side right now. I'm making pretend I'm looking at risk. I don't know. It's very weird right now in the booth. Risk, I don't respect you. I'm not scared of you. Reward is much more interesting to me. And so my optimism and my history and my successes allow me to really weigh the upside more. A good example is when I invested in Meerkat. Meerkat live stream platform. At that point, I already knew about Periscope. Periscope is a platform that's, by the way, hindsight, Periscope's winning, and I knew why they could, because they could use Twitter. Twitter bought it. It was infrastructure. Meerkat was solo by itself. I knew Facebook would come. Sure enough, they did. Facebook Live. I myself, as an investor in Meerkat, am using Periscope and Facebook Live more. But I still knew that if Ben Rubin, the CEO, did the right things, if a couple things clicked the right way, that even though Meerkat was kind of like the incumbent, it could win. And so I weighed the upside because if it had won, it'd be a billion-dollar company, multi-billion. And so I had to make that bet because the upside was too big for the risk. I do that every day. I really think that if you value or overthink risk too much, your upside as an entrepreneur is very limited.
Question number 7. Does instability with China and the macroeconomic environment affect how you see the world?
100 billion percent. I'm not naive to what's going on in a macroeconomic climate. I also can't control it. So it affects me, but I don't over-respect it. First of all, 2001 after 9/11, when most of my business was on Wall Street, as you can imagine, affected. 2009, 7, 8, when I started VaynerMedia, affected by the macroeconomic climates. Those were my biggest growth years. I referenced it earlier that I'm a wartime general. Let me explain. I like running businesses during tough times because the only people that win are the super A's. No more winning for B and C players during a tough time. There's not enough food for the B and C players. I'm a super A. So the bottom line is I'm paying attention to it. It affects me. I could lose money on paper. But for example, VaynerMedia explodes if people become tighter with their budgets because what I do in marketing actually has value. So, you know, this is how I see the world. So I do pay attention. It does affect me. I'm not blind to it. I always want to pay attention to what can cause me different outcomes that are not in my control. But I think my control allows more upside.
Question number 8. How beneficial do you think patents are in being able to set up a startup apart from the competition?
Patents are not a thing that I like to talk about so much because I'm not really passionate about them. I've never thought about applying patents, you know. I know they're necessary, but it got really bad in the last 20 years. Everybody's like suing every, like anybody with a random idea is filing stuff and then waiting 17 years and hoping to use it against people. It's a dirty kind of world that I don't know. It's not a world I know super well. I took this question because I thought it was important for me to like ground my context because a lot of people were asking me. I don't know. It just seems like patents have gotten very far away from what they were intended to do so long ago. It seems not practical to me, and it's something I don't spend a lot of time on.
Hello, everybody. This is Eric Dellenbach. I'm the executive director and president of the Tim Tebow Foundation. I'm so grateful for the passion that Gary has for our foundation and so many other nonprofits around this country. It's my pleasure to read the next 5 questions of the Ask Gary V book. Thanks so much for having me. Number 1, why don't you invest in space, biotech, or life sciences?
Easy, because one of my most famous quotes of my keynote career is, "Hey guys, I was a really bad student. As a matter of fact, I used to read The Wine Spectator in class, in science class, because I didn't give a shit about Saturn." And then everybody laughs. It's because I failed science. It's because I have no idea about life sciences, biotech, and space. And I think it's a very, 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 very bad idea to invest in things that you don't understand. Period. Let's move on.
Number 2, how does geography affect your investment decisions? Is where the founders or their business is located important to you?
Yeah, I would say it's important to me, including little things that are practical, like how often can I get to see them? How much of a help can I be if they're in a different time zone? So international is something I've stayed away from for the most part, though I'm starting to do more of. But the thing that I'm most passionate about is that Pinterest started in Pennsylvania. Facebook started in Boston. A lot of the things start in other parts of the country and then end up in Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley has this big kind of attitude of all the best things happen there. Sure, because people gravitate towards there after the fact. It's like being a great actress and being born in Iowa, but then you go to LA or New York, you go to where the market is. So I'm very conscious of that. I know that great companies can start anywhere. Your zip code isn't predicated on your ability to create something incredible. You may end up in San Francisco, but more and more you may end up in New York and LA as well. So I think that it's really interesting times. It affects it, but it is, it's more practical stuff. It's not like, oh, you invented this in San Francisco, then you must be great. Because I've done a lot of early stage stuff, this stuff can come from anywhere.
Number 3. Will you ever play in syndicate platforms like Circle Up or AngelList in the future?
Let me talk about syndicates because I don't think a lot of people know about it. There's a new Jobs Act that Obama passed that allowed non-accredited investors to get involved in these deals. And so now you're going to start seeing a lot of like Kickstarter, like angel list stuff where I will sit at the top and say, hey, I'm about to invest in this company and you might want to put $500 into it. Before you couldn't do that. Now you can. And then I would take a piece of the action. I would take 20% of the upside as the person that got you into this deal. A lot of people are doing it. It's not something I've looked at yet. I've been very busy with my own fund and raising my new fund. It's been made for guys like me. A lot of my contemporaries, those super angels, Jason Calcanis, for example, has done it that I mentioned early. Yeah, it's something I may look at, but I feel like it's going to get a bad rap because I have a feeling a lot of people that can't afford to lose money are going to lose money chasing their Facebook. So I'm just kind of watching for now. I tend to like to watch most marketplaces for a little bit before I jump in because I like to collect context.
Number four, what should companies expect from their investors at each stage of investment?
Well, first, let's start with expectations. I think in general, expectations are dangerous, especially because way too many people are making expectations around investors, around assumptions. I also think a lot of investors are selling things that they don't deliver on. It's a pretty tough ecosystem, actually, right now. I think companies should expect their investors to do what those investors tell them they're going to do when they meet. The truth is that doesn't happen very often. A lot of VCs talk about all these other things that they could be doing. At the end of the day, what they're giving you is capital. And by the way, capital's enough. You need money. So I think this is more on the companies. A lot of people like to throw VCs under the table. I would tell companies to ask very hard questions if they're looking for smart money, which is the slang term for money that's going to do other things for you, help you raise the next thing, help you build your business. Everybody claims it. Most people don't do it. I only claim it around the thing I do best, which is marketing. But a lot of times I don't even get around to doing it because I'm stretched thin, which is why I'm trying to do fewer deals.
Number five, should founders always be the ones that end up running their company when and if they reach a $1 billion valuation?
Absolutely not. I mean, the leader of a company that's 50 million is not necessarily the same leader that is the one that can drive it to success at a billion. As a matter of fact, almost most often not. For every Bezos and Zuckerberg, I mean, I'm not even sure I talked about earlier that I can be, but I got to do it. Proof is in the pudding. I can say anything I want. I love the growth trajectory of like 3 to 500 million. Maybe I won't like having 400,000 employees, though I think I will. So I don't think so. I think that's crazy talk. I think historically it was never considered. Like if you go, 60s, 70s, 80s, because you thought you had to get a Harvard Business School person to do it after the entrepreneur did it. I think now more and more people are realizing the world is more entrepreneurial, even at the highest levels. And so that we're more acceptable to it because of the dot-com operators like a Bezos, like a Zucks. But I would actually argue 95%, 97% of the time it shouldn't. There are people that are going to break through and can do it from zero to hero. Chapter 17, Self-Awareness. In this chapter, I talk about reaching high without delusion, the biggest decision I've ever made, and whether IQ or EQ is more important for success in business. This chapter means a lot to me because I think the topic of self-awareness doesn't get enough attention. And yet, if there's one thing that's helped me win over the course of my career, well, I've said that about hustle and gratitude and all kinds of other things in this book, haven't I? Whatever. This is another characteristic that has really worked for me. If I could sell a formula made up of gratitude, empathy, and self-awareness, it would be my $1 trillion coconut water idea. My self-awareness is one of the reasons why I can comfortably say outlandish things and make hyperbolic statements. And I know that the same things that draw people to me turn others off and keeps them away. I'm okay with that because I think I can help more people and get my point across better when I'm an unfiltered version of myself. Knowing how you come across to others can often give you an advantage as an entrepreneur. Take sales, for example. You can set the tone in a scenario, anticipate how people might react, and thus be prepared to address their concerns and questions even before they've been able to articulate them. It's really a valuable tool to have in your communication tool belt, and it's something I look for and admire in others. Self-awareness is underestimated now, But I know someday when I'm in my 50s, 60s, or 70s, it will be the subject matter of the day. If there's a chapter in this book that you would read or listen to twice, I'd say it be this.
Hi, everyone. I'm Beth Comstock from GE. One of the things I work on is trying to get a company that's been around for 130 years to remember that it was once a startup and to try to be as fast and nimble as a startup. I'm also one of the many Gary V fans. He knows as much about entrepreneurship as anyone. So I'm really excited to read the next 10 questions in the Ask Gary V book. So thanks for having me. What are some easy ways to become more self-aware?
I know that probably sounded funny in your speakers, and that makes me laugh. Okay, this is a heck of a challenge. You know, if you asked me what's something I could spend time on that's not my business, I would go into two things. One, if unfortunately, I know I talk about some dark stuff here, but stick with me, guys. This is how I keep so happy. If something bad happens in my life with a disease or something like that, I could see me becoming very, very, entrenched in the advocacy of like repealing it and fixing it. And I could see that whole cliche thing playing out. The other one is if I really achieve my goals, I become the Jets owner and all this other stuff. And I've got some downtime in my 70s, 80s and 90s. I might explore self-awareness. Like, can it be taught? I'm not sure. The answer to this question is very difficult. One, I think the only practical execution of becoming more self-aware that I've seen is creating a very safe zone for the 10 people that know you best. Let me explain. Put the 10 people that you know best into a room with you, one by one, by the way, and tell them you're trying to understand yourself better and create a very safe zone. Tell them, Mom, you're not going to hurt my feelings. Sally, you're not going to hurt my feelings. Tell them, look, I'm doing this. I know you're going to say some things that I don't want to hear. You got to pound them. You got to pound them to tell you the truth. But collect that feedback over the 10 closest people to you. Gather it, read it, and address it in a black and white way, because the reason you're probably not as self-aware is your brain works in a black and white way. So you need the data. Otherwise, I really just don't have an answer. It's the most interesting thing for me because I am completely convinced it is the thing that brings people the most upside and happiness when they're at the height of their self-awareness.
What's the most common mistake founders make when building a consumer-focused business?
It's funny that we put this in the self-awareness chapter because that's exactly the vulnerability. They misjudge the market. That, you know, way too many people are not self-aware enough to know that the market is the game, not them. I never think that it's me. For all the stuff that you've heard so far that makes me think that I think I'm so special, I promise you, when it comes to this, when it comes to the market trumps me every single time. I don't think I have this gift or the audacity to think I'm going to make it great. What I do is I try and I try and I try and I get results and I adjust and I adjust and I listen and I adjust and I listen. Way too many people bet the farm on their intuition. Or what they think the world needs, or what they want the world to have. And so it's a lack of understanding of what consumers want. And it's such a big bet. The amount of consumer-based products that actually succeed, your app, your juice, your mixed nut company, your nail salon, these are all consumer things, right? You have customers. It's so low. It's so low. For every Instagram, there's a billion Insta shits. And so you've really got to realize that the lack of self-awareness really plays itself here, because you need to have confidence. I want to get this very clear. That's why I'm sticking here. You need to believe in yourself, but never think you know better than everybody when you're thinking about a consumer product. Know that you need to put yourself in a position to play out your intuition, but then leave room operationally and financially to be able to adjust to what actually happened.
It's good to understand our talents and weaknesses, but I fear we'll get trapped into a mindset of telling ourselves that there are things we can and can't do. Poet Robert Browning said, "A man's reach should exceed his grasp." I want people to try lots and lots of things. I don't want people to tell our children what they are and aren't good at. How can you incorporate that idea into your discussion about self-awareness?
I'm doing a lot of that, and these ones hit me hard. This is a tricky one because you've heard from me, and this is where I start becoming a contradiction. And understand that I do think that my autobiography, my last book, or at least the big one, the one I've been holding back on, is going to be called The Bridge. And the reason I'm going to call it The Bridge is because I think I'm pulling equally hard on opposite sides on a lot of issues, including my ego and humility. Here, and you've heard from me, I talk about in prior chapters a lot about blind self-esteem, honey over vinegar. You can do it. You can do it. We can do it. Yet, I'm visceral to a third place trophy, an eighth place trophy. So I'm very big on the beginning part of stuff. Don't hold anybody down in the beginning. But then when it plays out, it's actually very weird. It's similar to the question right before. Then when it plays out, you have to believe in the results and the meritocracy. Meaning, you should tell your kid that they've got a real shot of winning because it pumps them up. But when they come in eighth place, you don't tell them they won. Do you understand? And that's the point right here. I remember Ted Rubin asking me this question, a great marketing guy and very active on Twitter. It's a very tricky line because I think we're living in a world now where parents have become so interesting to me to observe from afar because they want everything to be so good for their kids. They're not letting them accept failure. And failure's real. And so I think you should encourage everything up front, but then you should respect results and deal with the ramifications.
Do you have any tips for presenting your consulting services to a potential client? PowerPoint? Video?
How am I supposed to know? Like, I don't know you. Like, are you good at making decks and that's how you communicate? Good. Do you have a great radio voice and you just want to play your voice talking about it? Great. Have you not noticed here that when I'm off the script, I'm free-flowing, but when I'm reading, I'm not as strong? Like, you have to know you. This is about reverse engineering you. As a matter of fact, I shifted the whole angle of this book. All these answers are, you know what I'm looking forward to? All the people that are actually listening to this book while they're watching the book's answers in real form, because you get to take both answers and put them against each other, because what I'm doing in the audiobook is I'm putting myself in the best position to produce the best audiobook for you. Same thing with selling. I don't use PowerPoint. As TV. Every time TV companies and TV stations and networks have asked me to read from a Chiron when I like co-host, I fail. But when I can just go ad lib, I'm a dominant player. So this question is very easy. Are you good at PowerPoint? Great. Are you good at making videos to tell your story? Great. Are you like me and you can walk in a room cold off of a 1 hour sleep and just go and win because you're good that way? Good. Know you. Self-awareness. Know your communication style. Put yourself in that best position. D-Rock knows he tells best stories when he's got a camera in front of him and he's recording that way. That's how he communicates better than the voice. That's how we all roll. Know you. Know you.
How does humor play a role in business, if at all?
Look, humor is one of the pillars of society. Like, I think it's actually probably, I don't know this, again, I think people cover these in other books. Humor might be one of the most interesting characteristics of a human being. I think it plays enormous. As a matter of fact, if you really look at like Super Bowl commercials, all those brands go towards humor. I feel like humor and high emotion, like tearjerkers are like the two, like, I guess movies is a good way to look at it, right? Like, there's not that many emotions you can play on and humor tends to work for almost everybody. So I think humor is quite important. I use humor. I use humor as an executive. I think when things are tight or scary, I use humor to break up the tension. But at the same token, back to self-awareness, I think there's nothing less exciting than when somebody's clearly not funny and they're forcing because they've romantically decided that they want to be funny. And so that's probably why it's in the self-awareness category. Good job, Stephanie Land, in categorizing these questions. So I think it's very important, but I think it's only important if you got it. I think it becomes less important if you don't, because if you're trying to force it, it could become detrimental.
What was the biggest decision in your life that made you successful today?
Do I have a story for you? This one taught me a lot of lessons, actually. I haven't told this story that often either. Mr. Molnar, fourth grade science, Edison, New Jersey, Martin Luther King, grammar school. If you were there during that time, hit me up. I'd like to reconnect with some of my old MLK homies from Edison, New Jersey. I got my first F on a test. It was stunning because in third grade, I was a good student. I don't know what happened in fourth grade. If the entrepreneurial juices really kicked in, you know, I was still a little kid, but it was a switch like you would not believe. All A's and B's, I guess predicated on it was basic enough for my brain to understand. And all of a sudden, I'm getting F's on a test. Here's what I learned. One, I don't know why so quickly, and I don't think it's because I gave up, because I don't think anybody thinks I don't have tenacity. I realized, oh my God, I'm not a student. I'm not kidding. I was like, I'm a businessman. But two, I learned something else. I actually took that F paper. I was supposed to get it signed by my mom. This was the first time I really lied to my mom, right? Like I took the paper and I hid it in my desk. And I remember going to sleep that night and I couldn't sleep, my conscience. I figured out how to get rid of my conscience pretty quickly there for a while. And then my dad brought it back and we got into that already. But I was scared crapless. I had to wake up in the middle of the night, tell my mom about it. And there was a whole to do. But it's probably the moment in my life where I decided I needed to own being a businessman. This is weird, guys. I mean, I don't know how many of you have fourth graders. I'm trying to think. Misha's what, six, first grade, seven, eight, nine. I was 9 years old. I was 9 years old, nine. And I really understood the impact of this F. Like I was some wisdom. I really think I'm an old soul. Like I think I was, had wisdom beyond my years. I really, 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 really was like, oh my God, I need to be this guy. I need to keep doing the lemonade stands and I need to sell my garbage pail kids. And I'm that guy. And I really kind of punted school. I fully punted school 2 years later, but that was the seed, that F, that test, that science play, that hiding of it to know that I didn't want to be a bad guy either because my conscience got the best of me. That moment changed my life.
What was the toughest thing you've ever had to do for your career?
That was definitely when I kind of made the decision to leave day-to-day operations of Wine Library and do something with AJ. I always know I wanted to do something with AJ. As he got older, it became more obvious that he wasn't going to work with my dad, so it wasn't going to be the expansion of Wine Library. The liquor laws were, you know, back to that screw you, Texas, were tough, like interstate shipping. My Twitter and Facebook and Tumblr investment, the timing just all worked out that it was obvious to me that it was time for me to do something else. But the thought of leaving Jeff DeRose, Brian Delatorre, Eric Kastner, Ian Doran, Brandon especially, my dad, Justin, my brother-in-law, Bobby. I'm giving shout-outs right now because I want to. The thought of leaving them from a day-to-day standpoint, and most of all, and this is just the truth, leaving the baby that I built. Like, I was such a big part of the growth of Wine Library. That was quite difficult to start something new, to start something fresh at the height of our strength. You know, I feel like there was a part of me that realized I was at the top of my game at Wine, and that became boring. The climb was maybe over. That was really tough. It's kind of like the emotions are starting to flood back right now. It was a very difficult time, and anger came into play for a little bit. I was like mad at everything around me because I could just start feeling it not unravel because I've stayed close to it, but it, you know, luckily I haven't had a lot of tough things. That was a very big positive. Both businesses, I mean, they're both doing great and everything's great, but that was tough. That was very, very emotional.
How do I keep low self-confidence from keeping me from succeeding?
I often say that self-esteem is the ultimate drug in our society, and really I wish that I could sell self-esteem because I'd owe the Jets tomorrow. You know, you want to be honest? I don't think you can. If you have low self-confidence, the ability to be successful is not very high. You're just not going to believe in yourself. You're not going to take the risks. You're not going to put in the work. You're not going to make those jumps. It's why I believe so. And, you know, it's why I believe so much in therapy and things of that nature. Anything that can help somebody unwind whatever made them insecure as a child, normally parents, sometimes environment, sometimes one bad kid in school, a disability, something you were born with. Anything they can do to unwind that is something that I believe in, you know. And I believe in communication more than drugs, right? I think drugs are band-aids, and I think communication is how you actually get it out of your system. So you don't overcome low self-confidence to become successful. What you do is you attack low self-confidence, fix that, and then open up your door to success. I do think there's something I've figured out. I think my positivity and confidence absolutely amplifies around the people around me. I have watched myself make people that were less confident more confident by downplaying their insecurities and uplifting their skills. And so the only other answer I have besides therapy or a group of people or whatever allows you to get that poison out of your body, the only way to really do it is surround yourself with people that are highly confident and are kind and want to deploy, you know, that confidence on you. So I think the two answers are get it out or find people that are so willing to lift you up that after a while, You just, you know how they say you act like the five people you're closest to? You know, all of a sudden you just start changing. I mean, it's been fun for me to watch. It's probably the thing I get the most pleasure out of. It's probably why I do the Ask Gary Vee show. I am single-handedly, and I'm willing to say this, lifting certain people with lack of self-esteem to a higher level of confidence through my sheer confidence and my sheer, pounding them with making them believe.
A lot of small businesses fail because they refuse to accept when they're not good at something and insist instead on doing it themselves. How would you suggest telling someone they need to stop?
Direct to their face, Mike Tyson punched the jaw, the truth, angry, aggressive, because if they're not, again, this is step two. I'm assuming you've done the honey. Hey, sweetie, you shouldn't do that. Hey, sweetie, you shouldn't do that. Listen, I think I'm secretly still a proponent for hitting kids. And that's going to probably get a huge reaction on social, so I'm ready for it. I'm not saying beat the crap out of your kids, but I got to be honest with you. You know, if the little guy doesn't understand 63 times of honey, maybe a little tush slap wouldn't be the worst thing that ever happened. It's not so crazy that it used to work that we're in such a politically correct world. Now, Lizzie's not going to let me touch the kids. Deep down, I'm probably not willing to touch the kids. But it's kind of the energy that I'm trying to deploy in this statement. That's why I went aggressive with it, which is you've got to tell them, and more importantly, sometimes you have to do this, which is you've said your piece, you've tried to help them, and then you just let the market eat them up. That's what I love about business. The market, unlike your mother or your best friend or your business partner, they don't care. They do their thing, and either you win or lose. And if they suck at it, the market will prove it to them because they'll go out of business.
Do you think it's necessary to have an outgoing personality to be a successful entrepreneur?
Mark Zuckerberg, David Karp, Kevin Systrom, Ev Williams. These are the founders of Instagram, Tumblr, Facebook, and Twitter. Not all of them are huge, outlandish Ask Gary Vee characters. This is silly. Bill Gates isn't the life of the party from what I hear. I mean, absolutely not. That's crazy. As a matter of fact, I actually believe there's far more entrepreneurs that aren't so Richard Branson than there is. I mean, because that's why you know the few of them that are out there. There's not that many of them. As a matter of fact, I think I get disrespected for my chops because I'm a little bit of a character. So absolutely not. That's been proven. That's not an opinion. Let's go document the 7,000 most successful businesses in the last 100 years. And I promise 5,000 are not outgoing and 2,000 are outgoing. That's silly. Let's move.
Hey guys, it's Alex again. How do I overcome my people pleasing nature?
Why would you want to? This is super interesting to me, and society is very against people pleasers. It's viewed as a weakness. I would tell you that I am a stunning, aggressive, huge people pleaser. And it's the reason I don't fire as quickly as I should. So many of my small micro vulnerabilities, things that I critiqued already in this book, things that people can say about me behind my back, almost all of them are because I'm such a people pleaser. There's something more interesting. So much of my success, so much of what I've achieved, why I'm gonna win at the highest levels, bigger than all of you listening, is because I'm such a people pleaser. And that, my friends, is how I think about this. It makes me so mad that people have been taught that this is a negativity when I think it's a huge positive. So if you're lucky enough to have been born to people please, as long as you have your balance down, and I've talked about me being concerned long-term that I left too much on the table, which is people-pleasing. As long as you get enough for you, I talk about 51-49. So maybe I have a really good balance if I'm actually delivering on that 51-49. Give 51 to the other person. That's people-pleasing. You might be 80-20, and as long as that 20 is enough for you, you're good. But if 32 is what you needed, you need to move it up to that. So you need to decide what kind of people pleaser you are. And is that people pleasing coming so much at your expense that you're not willing to do it anymore? And let me explain expense. It's not just money. It's happiness. I get much more happiness out of people thinking I've changed their life than by making an extra 100K or million or 10 million. People pleasing, my friends, is a gift. Nurture it.
You get very personal when building your brand with the public. How personal is too personal? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I mean, I draw the line in a lot of places, right? Like, it's really hard to find pictures of Lizzie, Misha, or Xander. So I keep my personal life very, very private. Meanwhile, there's vines of me sitting on the toilet. And, like, I'm willing to have any kind of lighting. And I'm right now, as I'm reading this book, D-Rock is periscoping this to people. I'm always on the record. I think this is a personal question for people at every level. I'm not going to judge you on what you share, what you don't share. Is dressing sexy too much or not enough? Do you give away your best secrets or not? Everybody's got their own cadence. Everybody's got their own context. Everybody's got their own line in the sand. I don't think I should judge this. But what I think I can do right now to bring value to everybody's listening is nobody should judge this but you. The biggest reason people are being held back is they're worried about what everybody else thinks about what they're doing. Are you self-promoting too much? Are you showing a little too much skin? Are you giving away your best secrets? You should be monetizing that. Don't let anybody else judge your decision on this. The reason this works so well for me is I'm the judge and jury, with Lizzie being the only other voice in the world that can be part of this equation, because I'd like to game my cute kids for some more likes too. But the fact of the matter is, that's it. Don't worry about everybody else, and this will work out for you every time.
What do you think is more important in business, IQ or EQ?
I think EQ. You know, I just, at the end of the day, I think IQ is becoming commoditized. I think as information is at your fingertip on a Google search away in 1 second on your iPhone, how can smarts be as valuable as it used to be? I do think it's commoditized. I do believe that fewer people are born with exceptional EQ, but take this all with a grain of salt. It's because I'm such an EQ monster. My emotional intelligence is everything for me. And I'm sure some MIT person who's the greatest math skilled person of all time, Sally, let's call her Sally, who's made all her fortunes, all her happiness, all her travels, all her successes, met her husband, all the happiness came because she was book smart. She may say that. So what I do think is it's not a debate that information has been commoditized in an internet age. Right? I mean, there's no debating that. I can figure out things that I didn't have to memorize anymore. How tall is this mountain? Who's the president? Who's the CEO? How many ounces in there? It's all there now. And so I definitely think EQ will continue to gain momentum over the next 50 years as information continues to come to us faster, easier, cleaner, and thus becoming commoditized. Chapter 18. Gary Vee's Guide to Public Speaking Without Shitting Your Pants. In this chapter, I talk about punching people in the mouth, how to get away with F-bombs, and sticking to what you know. Fun fact, I did not give my first public speech until 2006, when I was 31 years old. It was at an internet conference. I really didn't know what to expect. But the second I took the stage, my world was never the same. Sometimes I wonder if my real talent is public speaking, not building businesses. I enjoy it almost as much. There may be no greater high for me than that second right before I walk out on stage. It feels like home. It's no secret that I like to hear myself talk. And this gives me the perfect excuse. But I really do tremendously enjoy connecting with my audience. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to speak to so many people on a regular basis. If you've done a good job of building your brand, there is a good chance someone will ask you for an interview or to sit on a panel. And eventually, if you're really good, to host a conference or deliver a keynote address. When this starts happening to you, you'll know you're on your way. It's not only fun, it's lucrative. I love it. I really freaking love it. I hope I can make you love it too, if you were like I was and unaware that it was even in your skill set. Given how many times I'm asked to speak per year and the somewhat, how should I put it, colorful way I tend to express myself, it's no surprise I've gotten a number of questions about public speaking on the show. I hope these answers will help you prepare for your moment in the spotlight.
Hey guys, it's Leo Laporte from This Week in Tech, and I am so excited to be reading the next few questions in the Ask Gary Vee book. I've known Gary for so long. He's kind of my hero, and I'm thrilled to be able to do this. So are you ready? Let's get going. How do you prepare for an important keynote?
This is going to be fun to answer for me for so many reasons, because I think I come at this a little bit different than a lot of people, and thus has probably created some of the events that have happened to me as a public speaker. First and foremost, I don't prepare. And that's just the truth. I'm very improv driven. I let the reaction of the crowd dictate me. I'm very counter puncher. Jab, 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 right hook. You know, I let it come to me. I'm not good. There is no PowerPoint in my career. I don't think a whole lot about much of what I'm going to say, but here's what I do prepare for. First and foremost, I have to know who's in the audience. If I do not have the context of who's in the audience, and I don't mean male, female, 20-year-olds or 60-year-olds, I mean what do they do for a living, and what's the number one best thing